My name is Ben Vincent, and as you've guessed, I'm probably from, probably have guessed, I'm from Bristol. And I worked quite close, well, Roland Baddie was my PhD supervisor, and this is the work I'm going to talk about. I mostly did kind of alongside him. But at the moment, I'm working with Ian Gilchrist and Tom Trashanko, who are more kind of experimental psychology people. Overall, what I'm hoping is this talk is going to be completely atypical of the ones that have happened so far, in that most of them have been quite technical and have been emphasizing neural coding and Granger causality, basically. This one hopefully will get people thinking that there is some technical stuff in there, but hopefully it's going to mix it up a bit. So basically, some people have heard of neural energy efficiency, some people haven't, but the basic idea is that the brain might be working in an energy efficient way. And what I'm going to talk about today is how this might relate to from low level neural efficiency to higher level neural efficiency. And it is just a hypothesis. So first of all, I'm just going to say some introductory stuff about the brain, which I gather quite a lot of people don't know too much about, because there are quite a lot of people who are into maths and physics and are just getting into the brain. Then I'm going to introduce energy efficiency and how I test if this is a useful approach to take in trying to explain what the brain does and why. Then I'm going to relate energy efficiency to building models in a very general way and say these have got properties to models that animals and humans seem to employ. And then I'm going to relate all of it back to energy efficiency again. So one, this is quite basic, but basically the idea is if you want to find out what the brain is doing, there are a couple of ways how you can figure this out. Going from neuroanatomy, which is just looking to see what is wired up to what. Imaging stuff, you make someone do a task, what areas of the brain become active. Electrophysiology, more lower scale, trying to work out what neurons are doing, things like this. Up to higher levels, such as experimental psychology, which can actually be. Some people are quite skeptical of the usefulness of experimental psychology, including me actually, but it can actually be quite informative.
Sorry, this is opposed to what other psychology?
Sorry?
This is
Oh, social psychology,
opposed to how?
which is all of that stuff like you walk across the road because your dad told you to do it when you were three or something. Okay. So these are basically two types of description which have been used, and I think people might need a bit of clarification on. First of all, you've got this receptive field idea, which is basically what you're trying to do is stick an electrode in some neuron, show it the world, and just kind of see what aspects of the world it responds to. And you can do this by a load of methods. But essentially, what you're doing is saying, what did this neuron respond to with respect to the world? So, this is a retinal ganglion cell neuron, for example, which responds to a kind of a bright blob if you shine it in the right place. But if you shine your blob in this inhibitory surround area, then it will inhibit the firing rate of a neuron. This is the same with a primary visual cortex neuron, like a simple cell, for example, but rather than responding to center surround blobs, this one responds to oriented bars of certain spatial frequencies. One of the advantages of a receptive field is that you can infer some kind of structure. So at the retinal level, for example, it's very easy to trace back where the connections are. And so you're not just talking about this neuron has this property, but you're also talking about this neuron has these specific links to other neurons. So you're getting into kind of neural architecture. The higher you go up the system, the more complicated it gets. Another way of describing what neurons are doing is the tuning curve. So taking this V1 neuron, for example, at the bottom you have some stimulus parameter, for example, orientation, and the curve describes how the cell will respond to different orientations. The only thing is, and this is completely fine, but that's just one stimulus parameter. There may be lots of different other stimulus parameters which the cell also responds to. So you don't get a complete description of the neuron from just one, for example. And there are relative merits of each, and they're all complementary. This is almost a patronizing slide of methods of working out, once you've figured out kind of what your brain or your neuron does, you can figure out kind of how does it do it. And so there are loads of different levels you can pose this question on to have some kind of desired explanation, from subcellular stuff to systems level. And these are loosely correlated with different type of techniques, which range from looking at biochemistry and genetics to information neural networks and, again, experimental psychology. Okay, so another question is, if hopefully you've figured out what the brain is doing and how it's doing it, the next question is kind of why? And this is, well, it's kind of a big question, really, and I don't think many people have had a go at trying to figure it out. Although some people have, obviously. One way of doing it is the optimization approach, which is just to propose that your brain is optimized to do something. You guess what it is, and you test this idea. You make predictions and just test them. So jumping in, I'm going to be talking a bit about sensory coding. I'll just describe this picture first, actually. Say you've got a series of inputs. So these, for example, could be photoreceptors in the retina. And you have a set of outputs. Factor analysis generally would say that these outputs are encoding information in some way. And, well, it's quite general, but that's pretty much it. So one particular incantation of that is principal component analysis, where you can have different forms of factor analysis where you put additional constraints on what you want this thing to do. And in principal component analysis, what you do is try to find directions in your space which grab the most amount of variance. So the first principal component will grab this dimension, and each subsequent principal component is constrained to be orthogonal to the previous ones. And so this has some useful properties in that it will decorrelate inputs, for example. If you apply this to natural images, this might require a bit of explanation. Each one of these blocks is the receptive field of some kind of hypothetical neuron. And the color at any particular point is the sensitivity of this neuron to some point in space, to some photoreceptor. And so as a first guess, as a first look, these things, although they exhibit some kind of nice properties, you get some things that respond to kind of bars, and things, they're in the minority. So overall, principal component analysis isn't a very good first guess at what's going on. Another way of...
Just sorry, what did you say? Something because you're assuming that neurons will only see bars?
The reason why I'm saying it's... The approach of factor analysis is kind of good in that you're transforming some data into some other representation, but the specific principal component analysis isn't good because if you go into neurons and record their receptive fields, they don't look like these. So if they did, you would have neurons which respond to lots of different things with no real coherent spatial structure, or there'd be a small amount with some. And these would be active all the time, but these things would be active hardly any of the time, because these, the first principal components grab
so
most...
You're just thinking of V1, you're saying? Because there are neurons if that see faces and neurons that see bars in V1, so presumably there are things in between.
If you try to stick your electrode in any area which is supposed to be some representation of visual space, you won't find receptive fields that look like this. Is that?
Did you say so? Okay.
Well.
It's maybe like the V1, like the first one, first one there doesn't look like that. Absolutely. But none of them look like that.
Sure. So, an alternative approach is independent component analysis, which some people probably know quite well. Which it relaxes this assumption that your dimensions are orthogonal. So this is a really stupid example where you have some kind of two measures and you can take these two measures and point them at stuff and you get a reading which is just a point in this space. And so in this stupid example you would get a cluster of dots which respond to dog-type objects and some that respond to pig-type objects. And the advantage of independent component analysis is basically it can just grab these dimensions and pull things out. This is a really stupid two-dimensional example. But when you apply it to natural images, it makes a bit more sense. This is the same as the other slide. But instead of having these bizarre, unbiological-like receptive fields, you get sets of oriented bar detectors, basically. What this is saying is, assuming some kind of generative model of data, you're saying the world is made up of a number of components. And what independent component analysis essentially would be doing is to try and pluck out what these individual components are. And so these receptive fields do correspond very well to receptive fields found in the primary visual cortex.
What do you mean very well? There's a quantitative measure?
Yes. There are loads of different flavors of independent component analysis. I think Van Hatteren did quite a thorough analysis, a comparison basically, where you can look at the distribution of orientations of these things, the distribution of spatial frequency sensitivities, all of that type of stuff. And it seems to fit quite well with similar measures taken of the primary visual cortex. So
the distribution of orientation and spatial frequency in the PCA or other flavors does not correspond well with that?
Well, I mean, if you look at, if you look at it, I mean, there are only a few which pick up kind of oriented lines.
Well, but I mean, you're talking about frequency and direction. You're not talking about details of the receptive field. I bet those guys corresponding pretty well in orientation and frequency, just as good as the other one.
If they do, the ability of principal component analysis to explain what's going on in biology is flawed because quantitatively they look nothing like receptive fields that you find in biology.
Well, what I'm saying, you're unfair, because if you use the same comparison as you said, whatever available, this one are similar flavors of those guys, and variation, like LCA or whatever, they have similar properties.
You may be correct, but if you have principal component analysis, independent component analysis side by side, which one would you pick? The one with nice oriented bars.
Right, but then you are using a different criteria. Now you are saying nice oriented bars. You didn't talk about those quantitative comparison anymore. Those quantitative comparison you just cited, I don't see the difference.
So
I
think perhaps if you look, for instance, at frequency sensitivity over this ensemble, and you look at the frequency sensitivity in the main component ensemble, sure, and then you look at the frequency sensitivity that you find in V1 cells, extremely biased towards high frequency sensitivity, much more than the independent analysis.
Oh, I'm pretty sure the independent components analysis is also extremely biased to that.
It is biased to the frequency as compared to what you find experimentally, but certainly not as grossly biased as the BCA.
Well, I think BCA ensemble, if you change a little bit flavor like LCA or other similar analysis which has done before, you get similar frequency response. Maybe sometimes even better than LCA. I'm not convinced for that criteria.
But there's one other thing to mention. If you train on grouping images instead of these static image patches, you end up with spatial temporal receptor fields whose frequency selectivity is much better matched with what you see in V1. And that was the second paper by Rowan.
Yeah.
So. No, but there are other PCA related flavors. They also apply to spatial temporal frequency domain. They also get pretty good matches. And I'm not convinced by that criteria you can distinguish those.
Well,
spatial temporal is a field like geratic. I want you to give us a more better criteria to distinguish this. If you think there is a good one, I think most of the comparison nowadays in terms of ICA, they are more or less kind of not so much in terms of favor.
Okay, so one quick point, but I'll move on because I've got quite a few slides. Principal component analysis is restricted to having a complete or undercomplete representation, so you can't have more principal components than you have input dimensions. This doesn't make any sense in the primary visual cortex because you have far more primary visual cortical neurons than in previous layers. And this is something which independent component analysis excels at when you have an overcomplete representation. But these are points and we should talk about it afterwards. One of the properties of independent components, if you show these things natural images, which these things were derived from in the first place, if you look at the distribution of output, so each one of these things will have some kind of output which equates to a firing rate. That distribution will be zero peaked, which means that many will be very weakly active or entirely inactive, and a low proportion will be quite strongly active, which relates to the sparse coding, which people may have heard of, which is pretty similar to independent component analysis.
Why is it symmetric?
Oh, just because the way how people build the models, your output neurons can have positive and negative values. Yeah, it's just because the natural images, a pre-processing step is to zero mean each image segment. And so, but people have implemented it. The guys in Finland have implemented a non-negative version, and it does pretty much the same thing. So, one of the questions you can ask is, with ICA and sparse coding is, okay, you've got this zero peak distribution of firing rates in your ICA model. You've also got them in physiology when you stick electrodes into V1 and IT, places like that. But why should sparse coding be interesting? Why do I want most of my units to be off? I mean, but one interpretation of why that would be a useful thing was by Bradley, who basically said that, it's just an interpretation basically, that if you have a ton of neurons encoding things, if there is some limitation or cost involved with how frequently these cells fire, or their average firing rates, then the optimal distribution in order to maximize output entropy is exponential.
I want to bring a point here. I mean, people use sparse somewhat loosely in two senses. One sparse as a small proportion of the neurons firing together, and the other sparse as having an exponential distribution. And those are two different things.
Yeah, there are lots of different measures. Some people use kurtosis. When I refer to it, I simply mean a zero peaked distribution.
Of what? Of the firing rate of single neurons or of the.
With this.
Of the proportion of neurons firing?
You can. It's both. So if you look at any one time instant, the distribution of firing rates, that is zero peaked. But if you look at one neuron over time, the firing rate is also zero peaked. And Wilmore and Tolhurst, I think, looked into this, how the two relate, enforcing different types. Yeah. But when I refer to sparseness, it is quite a loose term, and I just mean zero peaked distributions, basically.
So here in the picture you have less y's than x's, but you said that in fact you have more principal components.
Yeah.
So how is it done?
Oh, well, this is just an example. This is just a picture from a slide you'll see in a minute, which is something that I do. But you can have any number. You can have the same, more, less. The reason why people look at...
When you do this independent component, you assume, you have to assume in advance how many components you want to take, right?
There, it's possible, there is one package out there which finds the probability or the evidence for having a number of independent components. I don't think anyone's actually particularly looked at the optimal number, but this is what I'll kind of come to this basically. But you pluck the number out of the air essentially.
I just wonder maybe the sparseness that you get is.
Oh, you can do.
So you don't need them all to represent a given picture.
You can do independent component analysis with less dimensions than the input dimensionality, and you still get. Yeah, but what happens is they're much more broadly tuned, so they respond to. They're less narrowly tuned rather for orientation and spatial frequency. In order to actually code what's there with less neurons.
Can you elaborate a little bit of how you relate this number of spikes in neurons to energy interpretation?
Sure. I'll just check that. Okay. If you in this model, when you show a natural image to these photoreceptors, this will lead to a set of output activations, and it's kind of like an assumed thing that these loosely correspond to firing rates. So what you can do is basically assume some cost function, some cost as a function of what the firing rate is, and then you can impose that in your model.
So firing rate is equivalent to energy?
It depends how you define the cost function. if you define cost as the absolute value of the firing rate, this translates into enforcing a Laplacian distribution of things, but I'll come on to this.
Right, but I mean, energy is a physical term.
Yes.
There are lots of physicists here. You mean like...
Oh, I'm talking about metabolic energy expenditure. Actual number of ATP molecules in order to required to cause a firing rate, a given firing rate.
So you're assuming so certain energy consumption for each spike.
Yeah, and you can assume that this is linear, sublinear, or superlinear, and see what the simulations do. And I'll come on to this more.
And you assume when the brain is quiet, there's no spikes, it doesn't consume any energy, right?
Only if that's the only cost you put in there. And this is stuff I'm coming into about other types of cost. I'm going to be coming onto this, but you're quite right. It could be that neurons which release inhibitory neurotransmitter could effectively be cheaper overall. But I'm going to move on to this kind of exploration of costs and stuff. But first of all, I mean, the general idea of energy, raw energy consumption, would seem to be quite an intuitive idea that would seem to impact quite strongly in brains. When, if you look at organisms and what they do, the vast majority of them, i.e. not higher organisms and predators, seem to spend an awful lot of their time looking for food, and quite a lot of them die because they don't get enough food. So if you can be efficient, do the same amount of work for less energy, then you've got some kind of evolutionary advantage over a less efficient guy. So this table basically shows there are lots of examples in biology about evolutionary optimizations, especially in locomotion. So this table is basically showing, well, look, if locomotion use of muscles is expensive and optimized, the brain is also expensive, so maybe it's optimized as well to be energy efficient, and this is what I'm going to test. So in order to kind of approach this thing, I've already mentioned that you've got cost in terms of firing rates, but I'm splitting functional cost factors up into three main categories, and this is kind of arbitrary but a sensible first stab. So one cost is going to be, you can have a number of neurons just sitting there not doing anything, but they're still going to require some energy to stay alive and to maintain resting potentials, things like this. What's going on at synapses is tons of stuff, including release of neurotransmitter, packaging them up in vesicles, pumping ions in and out. There are other kind of costs which the brain might kind of incur, but these are more kind of structural things, which there are some people arriving at some point who work more on this stuff, so I'm not really going to go into that. But they're more kind of structural rather than functional.
So I have a question that may sound a little facetious, but I often wonder about, which is if energy optimization and wiring optimization and all these things are really such an issue, then why is the elephant brain that much bigger than the human brain? Volume? Yeah. That number of neurons in the cortex are larger
and more. How much cortex are the biggest, the whale brain is about 5 times bigger?
I mean, it's significant, right? So why?
That's not too much.
Well,
for an animal, that's like
markers. They could well be big, but they might, their neurons might not fire very much.
More number of neurons.
So maybe elephant neurons are cheaper relative to firing rates and action potentials than in humans.
But you also have just some structural, I mean, you have some costs that are associated with just the existence of the neuron.
Sure.
For example, a lot of the cost of the neuron is actually maintaining it at its resting potential, because you're constantly, that's when you're constantly pumping out ions.
So my basic answer to that would be, it's not about minimization, it's about efficiency. So elephants may require a big brain in order to do stuff.
Well, who knows? That's my question. It seems like maybe that's not the constraining factor.
It might be a little more complicated because it could just be a total proportion of the metabolic activity of your body. And if you think of it that way, then the elephant brain might be relatively uncostly relative to all that number.
Yeah, you see all of these very well-behaved power laws. Okay, so what I've then done is to... So yeah, sure.
So, but why is it? Why does one want to optimize energy consumption? If we have two organisms, one they just trying to figure out who's going to eat whom, then maybe you just want to consume as much energy as possible, but be a 0.001% better than the other guy and actually eat him and then get all of your expenses back.
Right. So this is a competition, so maybe there's three guys, and whoever's most efficient is going to do better.
If I'm just 0.01% better, more efficient than everybody else, I'm just going to eat all of them, and eventually...
Over evolutionary time, that's going to push people upwards in terms of efficiency.
Let's not forget that animals do very well without brains. So we're talking about the niche here.
Sure.
It's the case that animals can to make their brain as small, because if this is something that is not magnetic, we tend to kill it because consuming energy doesn't do that. So instead of having a sparse code, it's better to have a small number of neurons but compact code all the time used.
Let's just talk about generic cost function. And at this point, I don't know if it makes a lot of difference. Whatever cost function you pick, it's always going to be criticized. So let's try to just sort of look at the global picture and say, given a cost function, what am I going to do? And we'll go from there.
Okay. So we've got a situation where firing rate efficiency seems to be quite a useful thing in the visual cortex. So what I've done is to basically look at the data I'm going to present is looking at efficiency in terms of synaptic activity. So I'm using the same basic model, and I've just got this cost function. This is basically just my mean squared error, which is just saying I'm pumping information in, I want these output units to encode that information as well as possible. And then I've got a cost associated with weights, and again, for the data that I'm going to show you, I'm assuming that this is one. So the cost is proportional to the absolute value of your synaptic connection. And for the moment, I'm ignoring output values.
I'm sorry. Error squared is the first term is the error squared. Can you explain that again? I'm sorry.
Mean squared error. So what you have is, once you've got a set of output activations, you then try to predict what those inputs were. If you can predict those inputs perfectly, then you've encoded all the information and you haven't lost any.
So you try to do best reconstruction from your output, and then
What
are those P and Q ones?
Sorry?
The P and the Q.
Oh, these can basically just tweak the nature of the cost function. So you might think that it's linear, which is what I've assumed here. You can just tweak it so that the cost is proportional to the square of the value of the weights, for example. Well, for example, one reason why would be, once you've spent a load of energy, you've depleted reserves, for example, in neurotransmitter ions within. So maybe another mechanism kicks in. You've got to spend more energy. It's just a way of looking at different types of cost function, really basic way.
It's not extensive.
Sorry?
It's not extensive in the size of the network.
I don't understand what you mean.
I mean, it's not proportional to the number of weights or the number of some other microscopic variable here.
No, it's just a number that I'm, a cost function that I'm picking.
It's like a weight penalty with an LP norm.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, the question is, does it scale well?
Does it scale with the size?
We usually care about
it. Oh, well, that is why there's this alpha parameter, so maybe if you've got neuron...
Alpha increases scaling. Alpha increases the scaling problem, but that is
talking
about...
Unless you get alpha depending on P.
Yeah.
Well, P were zero, wouldn't you just give them the number of weights?
Yeah,
and that's a specific. Yes, that would be.
Do you have more weights, or would it be more of a cost?
So that would say if you've got any kind of synaptic activity, that will give you a cost, no matter how strong it is. I mean, that's just a cost function. And for the moment, I've just assumed the most simple thing, which is, well, a simple thing, which is just that the cost is linear, and I'm just going to see what happens. First of all, this is without any cost function on the parameters, the weights. And so you're only trying to maximize the information being encoded by these things. And you get these, and I've defined you've got this number of output units. You just get these big blobby things.
So these are the W's?
Yes. Yeah, so each of these is like a column of the W matrix. So these things
should be similar as PCA.
Sorry?
This should be similar as PCA.
Yes, but they're similar in that they're orthogonal, but they're not ordered in that in PCA the first principal component will grab most of the variance. In here they all grab equal amounts of variance.
So just rotated in this PCA space.
It spans the PCA subspace, although I'm not entirely sure what that means. So, okay, these are now results where I've put synaptic energy efficiency in there. This is for a linear cost function, and I've just said this is a particular type of cost. And what you get is local receptive fields where, I don't know if you can see, but they are central excitatory blobs with surround inhibitory areas, which are exactly the same as the difference of Gaussian type of model of retinal ganglion cells that I showed at the beginning. So this is good.
Positive alpha and P2 equals 1.
Yes.
So does the Gaussian part of the weight is being analyzed?
Mm.
So what is the patterning where, as you go to the left side, the
Oh, I've just ordered them so that it doesn't mean anything. They're not spatially located or anything. I've just ordered them so that it looks nice. I've just because positive and negative are equal, so I've just sorted the polarity of them as well. So yes, you do, but it doesn't mean anything.
If all of them that you want to superimpose all the squares, you would get all white, but the whole... If you superimpose all the little squares, it would all be white, right? So you're covering the visual field.
Yes, and I've got a plot of that. Okay, so this thing, I'm going to try and rush through. This thing makes lots of different predictions. You can just go in there and test stuff. If you pump noise into the inputs, the optimal receptive fields change from center surround to just a bigger center, which is exactly what happens in the retina when you go into a dark room where your signal to noise ratio is lower. It's basically spatial averaging. That's what they look like. It works with different convergence ratios. And yeah, this is a plot of the tiling of the space. These are difference of Gaussian fits. I'm doing a load of current work which looks at basically tweaking all of the things, looking at different costs, and also looking in foveated visual scenes and auditory stuff, but I'm not going to talk about that. I might overrun slightly. So now I'm kind of getting into this thing of going to link this cost function in a very general way to models. And I justify this in a minute. But basically, if you have some kind of cost on your weights, which are just parameters in a model, this equates to having a prior, if you look at it in Bayesian terms. And what basically this is the one we're interested in. It equates to a Laplacian prior, which just works like that, basically. If you just if you have a Laplacian distribution of weights, if you just take the log likelihood, it turns into you're going to want to minimize that quantity, which is just the sum of the absolute value of the weights. Okay, so now I look at this in... You can just apply this to a whole load of different models, whatever, linear ones, non-linear ones, whatever you want. So I'm going to look at linear regression just because it's simple and easy. And just see, this cost function has been good in the retina. It's produced some interesting results. So I'm just going to randomly, for fun, look at models with a similar thing. Okay, so paying attention just to this one. I've linear regression with 60 or 70 input variables, and these correspond to various measures of National Football League data, like number of home runs. I don't know NFL, so just stuff like that. And what you're trying to predict is... I don't watch it.
What's the left side of the equation, the right side of the equation? Regression?
Sorry?
What are the regressors and what are you trying to predict?
I'm trying to predict, in this particular data sample, I'm trying to predict the proportion, the percentage of games won in a season. And I'm trying to use various measures of how far people run and all of these type of measures that people seem to take of American football, which I don't get.
Some economic
levels in there. Oh, sure. Well, basically, if you just optimize, if you just do standard regression, mean squared error, these are the values of the parameters that you get. You can see that it's basically weighting quite a lot of the variables quite strongly. And there's also quite a lot of uncertainty in what these things should actually be. And I created these. The value of alpha, the actual relative importance of cost, I calculated using tenfold cross-validation to find that value. And once I found it, I got confidence intervals on the parameters using Bootstrap. But the basic property is that it pays attention to lots of stuff. It's making a prediction. And that prediction corresponds to a test error here, which is incredibly bad. One being equal to guessing the average of the number of games won in a season.
Can I ask you a question? Because when you predict, it's just simply along the horizontal axis, it's just a listing of all the variables you use in the regression.
Yeah.
And which ones you are plotting the corresponding weight after your model was trained?
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to, the Gaussian prior has this effect of scaling stuff down, which I'll describe later. But it yields a, in some ways, simpler model in that the parameters are smaller. But it's still weighting quite a lot of the inputs. The model with the Laplacian prior is vastly different in that it weights everything apart from one thing to zero. And one thing very highly, I went into the data set and I looked, you know, what is this? And if you're trying to predict proportion of games won, the actual predictor was the number of games won, in the season. And so this is very interesting because standard regression, the answer was in the data. Standard regression didn't get it. It didn't find it. Not only that, its ability to predict unseen data was crap. It was worse than chance. The Laplacian prior picked out this one simple thing, the actual answer. Sure.
Really an explicit requirement that
you have. In stats, this is not entirely new. I mean, lots of people work on regression, but if you bear with me, you will figure out how this fits into the energy stuff.
But is that also part of the reason? I mean, when you choose the energy function, the first term, which is square, you assume the data set is some kind of Gaussian, because that's or the noise is Gaussian.
I assume that the noise is Gaussian, yes.
But probably it's not true in this case.
Yeah. Even if it isn't true, it does a lot better than having no prior at all. I mean, I don't know if it's true.
The graphic with the Gaussian prior on the way to the prediction is that even assuming that the noise, which is to say, was the residual, is going to be Gaussian. I mean, the word Gaussian appears twice in that sentence.
You can have a different noise model, that doesn't matter. So what I did was then, what happens, this is exactly the same thing done again, but I took this variable out. So this is doing the same old stuff, not doing very well. And this then decides to say, oh, well, hang on, all these other things are important. So the fact that these things, which are important, aren't weighted here at all, shows, I think, essentially, in just in words, what it's doing is finding the simplest possible explanation, the simplest model, in order to describe the data. So you can describe the data simpler by just ignoring these things, even though they might actually have some kind of effect. This is some other data which where the actual answer was not in the input data sets. And basically, the lesson is that it doesn't just set most of the weights to zero. It can set the parameters to something useful if that is required in order to explain the data. So you can see that this is a bit more simpler than that, but it can pick out a complex model if it wants. This is another set of data which a student collected for me, which is the predictors are things like A-level results, school test results, things like this, and you're trying to predict the score in a second year undergraduate stats course. Basically, what happens is, with no prior standard regression, you get this weird elaborate model with predictive ability worse than chance. So if you believe this, you'd go away with some kind of strange, bizarre, convoluted thing which didn't mean anything. The Laplacian prior sets everything to zero, because from this data, given a linear model, you can't predict better than chance. And so it's just setting everything to zero, and it's saying, look, I'm not giving you some kind of bizarre model of the data. I'm telling you, you can't do it linearly. I'm anthropomorphizing a bit, but... So a wordy summary of the effect of a Laplacian prior, which is probably known to people who deal with regularization, is that it's good in that it results in the simplest model in order to describe the data. And my definition of simplicity is just, if you can ignore a variable, do it and set it to zero. But it does allow complex models. It can have greater generalization ability, which is really what you should care about. and it doesn't give you spurious solutions. And it does this by promoting zero values.
It's also non-differentiable at zero.
Sorry?
It's also non-differentiable at zero, so finding the solution might be very tough.
Yeah, I mean, I use gradient descent and stuff, and so these things aren't set exactly numerically to zero. And just lots of people have done some work trying to figure out how to deal with that.
If I can make a comment, this is ridge regression, just in case people want to put it over.
Ridge regression is when you have a Gaussian prior.
No.
Yeah.
Ridge regression assumes any. Well, no, but never mind.
Okay, well.
Just if people want to go to the library, I think, look it over.
Okay, well, I mean. As far as I can find out, having a cost function on the sum of the squares of the parameters is ridge regression, but, okay.
This is called Lasso.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and also Lars and all sorts of other things. So I'm not trying to say I've come up with this new statistical technique. I've just said, look, it has these properties.
Aren't there some people who did some linear programming to this, right? Where you don't really need to do gradient descent. You just have to solve the mean square error of L1 normal parameter. Like Donatello.
Sure. The reason why I chose gradient descent was because I just wanted to do one bit of programming which could work equally well on all types of models, like nonlinear stuff. It's just easier. So I'm going to try and be really quick. These models which you get out are very useful in situations when you have many variables, because quite often variables can be correlated and this confuses just standard regression. It's also good when you've got very few number of observations and these observations might be noisy. This is just basic regularization stuff. Some examples of where this might be, these properties would be useful is learning in the real world, for example. So I want to kind of learn all kinds of stuff about the world, and there are a near infinite number of measures I can take, but I want to learn very quickly, and there's going to be noise in there. So possibly a Laplacian prior type model would be useful. So the link to cognitive models is that there seems to be quite a lot of evidence by people like Gigerenzer in that if you put someone in a learning situation where they've got to extract trends from lots of different sources, and some of them have noise, some of them don't, people tend to not really act optimally, but just pick the simplest possible model. And his extreme case is they tend to pay attention to one variable. That's a bit too simple, but it's similar to what this does. Okay, so relating this back to energy efficiency, in a very intangible way, not intangible, tenuous way, and this is just ideas, I'm not claiming this is true. This is a very cool paper which basically says that people who are generally more clever, if you use IQ as cleverness, show lower cortical activation in problem solving. Lower cortical activation will relate to lower energy consumption, hopefully. And that when you learn, you go from a point of high cortical activation to lower cortical activation, and this is followed with an increase in performance at doing a task. So this is quite kind of interesting stuff. So this energy efficiency that I looked at on a neural level might vaguely be useful in a higher cognitive model building type of way. This is nearly finished now. Something that supports this as well is what happens in the brain after brain damage, for example, caused by accidents or stroke. What happens is when you get damage, your your performance at a task, for example, is very bad. And if you put these people in a PET scan, the number of cortical areas that are active increases, is very high. But as people recover their ability to perform a task, this extra cortical activation decreases. So again, this is a bit tenuous, and it may or may not be true, but at least it supports the notion that energy efficiency with some kind of linear cost function imposed on models of the world can enforce simplicity. And it turns out, due to the structure of the world, maybe simple models are effective, resulting in better performance. I don't know how ridiculous you think this is. I don't know. None of this is proven. But I'm not quite sure if this is true, which way the causality goes. If energy efficiency is constrained to cause simplicity, which helps you in the world, or if energy efficiency is a useful byproduct of some implicit desire to create simple models. So, overall summary, energy efficiency appears to be useful in the early visual system on a very, you know, low level, firing rates, synaptic activity. If you just abstract this to building models, it results in simple models which have a lot of very interesting properties which correlate to the type of models that humans seem to be using. Then there's also this kind of evidence that human cognition is in some way energy efficient, and there are lots more examples of it, but I didn't have time to show you. And so I've got this kind of vague notion that energy efficiency might go some way to explain why the brain is organized how it is. And that's it.